It's time now for the Sports Objective Podcast. No talking heads, just guys who love sports. Here's Dave Richmond.
Welcome into the Sports Objective, the unofficial podcast of the Pirates, and we like to have a lot of fun. And one of the things we always joke about many years, what, 2.5 years now, about how much we love wrestling. And ladies and gentlemen, the man that's can cut really good promos, I'm telling you, Kyle from LaGrange Barber. How are you, man?
What's going on, Dave? Yes, I would say my promo skills are right up there with Jim Cornette and Ric Flair and Matthew Green, Dusty Rose, baby.
I don't know about that, but they are legendary.
I know about that.
We'll let Mike Mooneyham, our guest, the expert, we'll let him hear some of your promos and see what he thinks. Another man that cut promos, and he loves, old school rap, hip-hop, and we'll talk maybe some the walking up music. We can talk about that. That's right down the aisle, and that's Pirate Al, better known as Alan Powell. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good, man. I can't wait to talk a little wrestling. I'm really looking forward to it.
And I'll let you introduce our guest. Very excited being a wrestling fan. I want to give you credit. I've heard his name before, but obviously we don't live in South Carolina to read his newspaper articles. I guess we can now looking back on things. But Pirate Al, who do we have on tonight?
We have Mike Mooneyham on. Mike's a Hall of Famer. He's in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. I actually met Mike a few years ago. They used to have the Mid-Atlantic. I believe it's called Mid-Atlantic Memories, maybe. It was the wrestling reunion in Charlotte. They built it a couple of years ago, but they had it, I don't know, Mike, 10 or 12 straight years, maybe longer than that. But there's nobody on this planet that knows professional wrestling and the wrestlers like this man.
Mike, welcome into the show.
Thanks. Good to be here. Yeah, I've been in this business for, the way time flies, it's unbelievable. Over 50 years, like 55 years. I started writing for wrestling magazines back in the mid-60s. And, one thing led to another, and I've been doing a wrestling column for my local newspaper since 1989. And it appears every Sunday in the Post and Courier in our sports section. Longest running column in the country. And I retired 4.5 years ago, but I'm still doing the column every Sunday. They demanded that I continue writing that. And it's been a labor of love for all of these years. Wrestling has sort of been a passion of mine since I was a kid. And it's been one heck of a long run. It really has.
What are some of the magazines you wrote for? The After Mags or what?
Well, before the After Mags, I did write a little bit for the After Mags, Inside Wrestling and The Wrestler. But I did reports for the old Ring Wrestling magazine, which has been around forever. One of the most popular magazines, Ring Wrestling, and they had a boxing magazine as well. Wrestling Review, which was very popular, Wrestling News, and just a bunch of the old magazines. I love the old magazines. I love the feel, the smell. Couldn't wait till the issues came out. And we didn't have newsletters. That's where you got most of your news. However, when I was like maybe 13, 14 years old, I started my own wrestling fan club called Championship Wrestling Fan Club. And back then it was sort of like a precursor to what would later become the newsletters, the dirt sheets, if you will. Mm-hmm. But I had correspondents all over the country, in most of the territories. We had 30-something territories back then.
What year was that, Mike, that you were doing your newsletter?
This would be late 60s, early 70s.
Oh, wow.
I had correspondents all over all the territories. And I published a monthly, what they call bulletin, but it was Championship Wrestling Fan Club. And did interviews and results. And, it was a little kayfabe back then. I was well entrenched in the business. And I would sometimes reveal who was behind the mask, which was, a big deal back then. Because, the magazines, those stories I found out when I actually started submitting articles to the early years of the After Mags, they started telling me that, we don't need All we need is photos. We don't need stories. And I wondered, you know, you don't need stories. How are you going to know what to do with the photos? And I found out quickly that they made up the stories. They wanted the photos, but they would make up their own stories. And I thought, gee, you know, well, I kind of fashioned myself as a journalist. I don't want to do this. And I got away from it a little bit, you know, went to college. But actually, I go back to pro wrestling. People say, well, how did you get into journalism? You know, you started writing for papers. I began working for a newspaper back in the mid-70s. And it was actually my wrestling journalism, the stuff I had done, was really an inspiration for me to go into journalism, you know, real mainstream journalism. But I always had that wrestling thing there. You know, I went to write wrestling stories back in the 70s for the newspaper. And not many people were doing stories in, you know, large newspapers about wrestlers or wrestling in general. But I did, and I became a sports editor at the Post and Courier in Charleston back in the early 80s. And whenever I could, I would spring a nice wrestling story on 1A of the Sunday paper. You know, I remember one story, I think it was back like in 81. I did this huge spread on Wahoo McDaniel. It was half of the front sports page and about two open, wide open inside pages, had photos and this long, long story. So I did that whenever I could. And of course, we published the wrestling results for our local shows here in Charleston. But it was in early 1989 that they actually, the executive news editor and I, we kind of, he actually brought it up to me because he knew I was a resident wrestling expert. And wrestling had gotten pretty popular on the mainstream level back then. And we talked about a wrestling column for the newspaper. And I said, okay, you know, once a month, what are you looking at? And he said, no, let's do it every Sunday. You know, that's our biggest issue for publication. We have more readers on Sunday than any other day. So let's go big time and do it on Sunday. And I said, okay, my only demand will be that we run it in our sports section. I don't want to run it in, you know, features or Lifetime or entertainment. I want to run it legitimately in our sports section. He said, done. So that was, it's been, you know, almost 32 years now, and it's been running every Sunday in our sports section ever since.
And you talk about the 80s, you know, being there in Charleston, South Carolina, North Carolina. Just this whole area was so hot in those days with promotions. And talk about, you know, some of the weekly shows. I don't remember Charleston. There's guys, some of you guys get a lot of background noise. I don't remember if Charleston was a weekly town for Jim Crockett Promotions or not. Was it weekly or bi-weekly or monthly in Charleston?
Oh, it was weekly. Every Friday night, 8:15 p.m., County Hall, be there. Yeah.
Okay. So that was throughout the 80s. And what are some of the – we'll just stick with Charleston for now, because that's where you're located. What are some of the matches – not necessarily even main events, but what are some of the matches that stick out to you from that period in the 80s with Jim Crockett Promotions?
Oh, gosh. Well, if I can go back to the 60s. I saw some of the greatest matches ever. Are y'all hearing the noises? Is that?
I don't know what that is.
Okay, it stopped a little bit. Okay. Back in the 60s, I saw some terrific matches. You know, my first wrestling show was in 1964. It was a three-match card. Back then, you know, you didn't have 8 matches, 10 matches, 20, 30 guys on the show. You usually had 3 or 4 matches, and usually 2 of them were tag team belts. But the main event was Johnny Weaver and Haystacks Calhoun against the Bolos. If you remember the Bolos, they were also known as the Assassins.
Oh, okay.
And
I know the Assassins.
Oh yeah, it was a great match, and it was like first match I ever saw live was that night. I saw Tim Woods wrestle Pedro Godoy, and of course Tim Woods later became Mr. Wrestling. Mm-hmm. The second match was a midget tag team match, Fritz and Hans Herrmann against Chief Little Hawk and Lord Littlebrook, and of course the main event was Calhoun Weaver against the Bolos. But that was the beginning of many, many great shows I saw. You know, I saw the world champions. I saw Lou Thesz, Dean Kaminsky, Dory Funk Jr., Jack Briscoe, Harley Race, Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes. Saw all of the great lineage of NWA world champions during that period. And, you know, I saw some fantastic matches. A lot of them, Flair was, you know, main eventing against Steamboat Classics. I saw Dory Funk Jr. and Jack Briscoe. Those two, in my book, were the most classic matches that I've in 50 years that I've been a fan that I saw. Briscoe against Funk and Flair against Steamboat. There's just so many great matches over the years. You know, I could go down a list. Some of my favorites actually were what they used to call the Battle of the Bullies. And those were heel teams against each other. And you talk about bloodbaths. I mean, this was like ECW 30 years prior to ECW, you know, and really Carolinas and Virginia, Jim Crockett territory was mainly a tag team territory back in the 60s. And there were so many Battle of the Bullies, Skull Murphy and Brute Bernard against the Bolos, Hawk and Hanson against the Anderson Brothers. The list goes on, but those were really, really hardcore matches. And usually the fans had a hard time picking out who they wanted. You know, it was pretty much split down the middle until the very end. And, you know, they would root for one team over the other. But, just so many memorable matches in this area. And of course I covered matches all over the Southeast. You know, I was a young kid, but I was on the road. I covered matches from Charlotte to Atlanta to Miami Beach, Orlando, Savannah, Columbia, Augusta, you know, and I really covered a lot of the Southeastern states, even, you know, back then. I was, like I said, I was a young guy. So I got to see a lot of good wrestling.
Did you ever make it over to the Memphis territory, Jerry Jarrett?
Nope, never made it there. Nope.
Okay.
Been in the area, caught some shows around there, like in Jackson and Nashville and stuff, but yeah. But of course, you know, I also covered that area pretty heavily. It was a very good area. The guys were smaller, you know, but they had pretty wild matches, and it was good stuff.
Yeah, me and Dave. Dave's got me by a couple of years, but not much. So, but we came up in the same era of wrestling in the 80s, and that's why, you know, I went there initially because it's, you know, what I relate to. And I think thinking of JCP, and we know where the noise came from. It came from Al. we could fast forward a little bit to the 80s. What are some of your memories from that era, the Jim Crockett Promotions era in the 80s? And, you know, like I said, it was a great tag team territory, you know, dating all the way back to the 60s and 70s. And,
yeah, well,
you know, then in the 80s, you still had the great lineage of tag teams with Rock and Roll Express and Midnight Express the Road Warriors and Tully and Arn on and on.
Yeah, really. In the 60s, tag teams in 73, it morphed into more singles guys. You know, George Scott became the booker, brought in Johnny Valentine, Super Destroyer, Blackjack Mulligan. So it became heavily a singles territory with a lot of good guys, you know, a young Steamboat, a young Flair coming through the ranks. In 80, it was just a little bit of everything, but you're right. So many great tag teams. You know, you had the Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express, Tully and Arn, Wahoo McDaniel and Paul Jones, the Andersons, of course. You know, I was lucky enough to catch the original Andersons, Gene and Lars. They were the original Minnesota Wrecking Crew. And, man, I saw some great matches. I thought Lars was great. I really liked that version. Also, they had some real bloodbaths with George and Sandy Scott. I don't know if you remember those. They were one of the top two babyface teams in the Crockett era back in the 60s, along with George Becker and Johnny Weaver. But yeah, the 80s had so much good stuff. But what I really remember, and I swear every time I go by the old building, I can still hear those chops and those sledgehammer blows. I saw some bloodbaths between Johnny Valentine and Wahoo McDaniel. And this is back, this goes back to the 70s. But I mean, those guys just, they were fantastic. I mean, those are some of the best memories I have of watching wrestling when it was real wrestling, you know. Wahoo and Valentine, two of the toughest guys in history.
Mike, when you mentioned going down, I promise I'll shut up and let somebody else talk here in a minute. You mentioned going down to Atlanta in the Georgia territory. How over? Because, you know, I always look back and think about them putting the belt on Tommy Rich just briefly. How over was he in the Atlanta territory with that WTBS television during that brief period of time? I mean, he had to be super over.
Oh, my gosh. No pun intended. He was on fire. I mean, Tommy Rich, you know, he was like a can't-miss prospect, but he burned out really quickly. And Tommy's a really good guy. Tommy, you know, I mean, it's a privilege. He only had the title for less than a week. But, you know, he's still got his name in the record book. And there's a short list of NWA, legitimate NWA world champions. But Tommy was so good. He was a young baby face. The gals loved him. The guys, you know, they so many followers that Tommy had during that period. And he was probably – he was really the main guy on TBS Superstation. He was drawing sellouts all over Georgia. And, you know, the deal with Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer. Talk about bloodbaths, man. They spilled buckets of blood and canvases all over that state. But he was really good. And, you know, he had Gordon Soley in the background. You couldn't have had a better guy that started directing traffic back then. So Georgia was really, really hot. I just love this whole territory. You know, you had the Carolinas and Virginia, which was Crockett. Then you had Georgia. And, you know, you had the promotional war back in the 70s with Gunkel and Ray Gunkel. And then you had
Williams
was the figurehead guy in Atlanta. And then you had Florida, which was tremendous. I mean, Florida had, with Eddie Graham, what a creative mind he was and the talent he brought in and cultivated in Florida. So we were sort of spoiled in this part of the country. And especially if you had a good antenna that could catch, you know, Georgia and Florida, and you had the Carolinas, if you had a good antenna, you could listen to Gordon Soley from Florida, Ed Caprell from Georgia, and Bob Caudle from here in the Carolinas. So it was a wonderful period of wrestling. And, you know, I don't think anybody had better talent than this part of the country.
Yeah. That's what I wanted to ask about Tommy Rich, because people from my era think of Tommy as a mid-card guy at best wrestling in WCW. He was never really used on top anywhere else except Memphis. They used him on top in Memphis after his run in Georgia. But besides that, he was kind of a mid-card guy. And even later, he was a comedy act in ECW.
The full-blooded Italians in ECW, yeah.
Tracy and those guys, yeah.
Yeah, actually, I saw Tommy about a year ago. He was down here in Myrtle Beach, and he had a wrestling school for a while.
Oh, wow.
I was hoping to get things started, but, you know, it didn't last too long.
And Mike, wanted to ask you as far as going back to, I think I was telling Kyle right before we started the show, our pre-show wrestling bit we had, but we were talking about wrestling and the territory days when Jim Crockett Promotions, my mother until just a few years ago did not know that my dad's dad, my grandfather, would let us stay up and watch wrestling on Saturday night. And that was a really big deal. And I guess they know now why we wanted to stay there with them on Saturday nights to watch wrestling. But to have Bob Caudle and to be able to late 70s, early 80s, I was telling him when to see a young Steamboat and teaming up with Jay Youngblood. And I could go on and on with all the guys. Yeah. But one of the things that I'm impressed with Kyle in many things, but one of the things is cutting promos. We were talking about that earlier about ECU sports, but to me, that's one of the things that I was thinking about this interview and thinking about the last night. One of the things that's missing for me is the charisma. And I was listening to the Arn podcast today. I'm a huge fan of Arn Anderson. And the fact that he said he never, I didn't get a chance to tell Kyle this because we had to do the show, but he never had anything scripted. It was all off the top of his head. And to have those guys back in the day, to me, that's what's missing from wrestling today, the cutting the promos.
You're absolutely right. I mean, everything is scripted now, you know, every to the minute, to the word. But back then, those guys, that was natural. They were loaded with charisma, and it was all spontaneous. I remember seeing Rick cut interviews. They used to do interviews once or twice a week, and, you know, they might do 10 or 12 interviews. You know, say we're going to be in Raleigh Tuesday night, we're going to be in Greensboro Wednesday, Norfolk Thursday, Charleston. So they would do all of them at one time. And I'm telling you, Flair could – he could go, that red light is on, and he could cut promo after nonstop. You know, I'm in Charleston, I'm in Greenville, different opponents and stuff like that. But that guy never missed a beat. I mean, it was amazing. You know, the camera loved him and he loved the camera. And that's why those guys back then, you know, you mentioned like Arn Anderson. Arn's great at promos. He's one of the best promo guys. And the fact is, he is in real life, he is so witty and funny. You know, he's got that wry sense of humor, but he can go all night long. I mean, those guys, that's what's missing today. When guys cutting a promo, you know, it's not coming from him. It's coming from a writer who may not have been a wrestling fan, you know, necessarily. Maybe he's out of Hollywood. And he's putting these words in the guy's mouth. And it's really, sometimes it's just not natural. You know, I know a lot of these guys, and I know, they wouldn't be saying that. That's not them. And it just, it's better when, it's so much better when it's natural and spontaneous. But that's a big thing that's missing today. Now, fans today, they might not know what they're missing from years back. You know, it might work for fans today, but if you've been around for many years like you have, you know what the real deal is.
Yeah, promos are terrible today. Like you said, and it's not the guy's fault for today.
No.
Everything is scripted. And another thing, and not to get on a tangent about today's wrestling, and it was better back in our day, but nobody sells anything anymore. It's high spot after high spot after high spot. Nobody sells anything. I mean, you watch something like AEW, and, you know, 30 seconds into the match, people will be hitting things that would have been a finisher or something that nobody would have even done 20, 30 years ago, let alone a finisher, and it doesn't even register. It's nothing. It just, you're right back up into the next house.
No, it used to be something, you know, you talked them into the building, right?
Yeah.
And we had so many great guys. You know, Thunderbolt Patterson was one of the best. I mean, he could cut a promo and go on. You know, he'd start preaching, but it was always aimed at making people want to come to the building and see the show. And he just had such a great interview style. In fact, his style was copied by Blackjack Mulligan, who was also a great promo man, and Dusty Rhodes. You know, the chucking and jiving and all that stuff. That was from T-Bolt. And they both, you know, they both admitted, you know, they're both gone now, but they both admitted that, you know, they got a lot of their interview style from Thunderbolt Patterson.
I heard, I was listening to Cornette's podcast the other day, and his co-host Brian Last played a Thunderbolt Patterson promo from his last run in WCW. Ole brought him back in 1990. And there he was on WCW TV in 1990. And he was cutting a promo and he was saying something. And I can't remember what he was saying. It was, God, I wish I could remember this. I'm going to miss the point without remembering what he was saying. But it really didn't make any sense at all unless you knew Thunderbolt Patterson. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was. He wasn't really saying anything. It was like, I feel it. It was something he was saying. Right. It wasn't I feel it. Right. Do you know what it would be? I can't think of what it would say. What was one of his regular catchphrases?
Oh, I'm full.
I'm full. I'm full. I'm full. That's it. I'm full. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I'm full. I still get him to do that sometime when I talk to him. You know, I'm good. Me and Bolt go back many, many years, a longtime friend. But I still have to get him to cut a little promo for me every once in a while. It's incredible. Guys like that, man, they were unique, and they were true, what I call true originals. You know, those guys. Speaking of,
I was going to ask you, staying on that that topic of Thunderbolt. What are some of, you know, when you think of great African American wrestlers of all time, Thunderbolt Patterson, JYD in his Mid South days, Ron Simmons, obviously, you know, first, you know, true world champion, African American. Who else comes to mind that you saw? Obviously, Kamala was a gimmick, but worked that gimmick great. Who were some of the other great black wrestlers that maybe you've forgotten about?
Yeah. Well, you know, Tony Atlas is good. Tony had a great career, as did a guy named Sailor Art Thomas back in the 60s and 70s. He had one of the best physiques, maybe the best physique in wrestling. And it was, you know, it was not enhanced by chemicals or anything. It was just, you know, it was a real deal. But Luther Lindsay, for my money, was probably one of the greatest black wrestlers that I'd ever seen. And Luther was, he worked in the 50s and 60s and 70s. He actually died in Charlotte about 1972 during a wrestling match. He had a heart attack.
Wow.
It was right there at the Park Center. He was wrestling one of the opening matches. And he actually won the match. A referee counted 1, 2, 3, tapped him on the back. Luther never got up. He died of a massive heart attack right there at the Park Center. Oh,
and Luther was – holy crap.
Yeah, Luther was only in his 40s. But, you know, he played football at Norfolk State. He was a great football player. And but he was even a better wrestler. He actually went to Stu Hart. And this was like back in the 50s and trained under Stu Hart. And to tell you how good he was, Lou Thesz, who I consider one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, said Luther was probably one of the top 10 guys, at least in the top 20 of everyone he had ever, you know, wrestled or seen wrestle. And that was some lofty praise coming from somebody like Lou.
But how big of a star was he? You know, I guess his prime would have been in the 60s or late 50s if he died. Well, you said he was in the 40s when he died. In his 40s when he died in 72. So his 60s would have been the majority of his career. How big of a star was he? Was he a mid-card guy? I mean, you're saying he was that good?
Well, he was. You know, it for black performers, it was sometimes a little bit harder for them to crack main events. But I saw him in many main events in the Carolinas working for Jim Crockett. And his regular tag team partner was Abe Jacobs. You know, Abe was great. You remember the venerable New Zealander? He's a Kiwi.
Oh, yeah, the Kiwi, Master the Kiwi Roll.
You remember that, Al? Yeah.
Absolutely, Master the Kiwi Roll. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you mention the Kiwi Roll to anybody, and they'll say Abe Jacobs. And, you know, fortunately, and Abe's been a good friend of mine for many, many years. Abe's still with us. Abe's like 92 years old.
Wow.
Wow.
And Abe was still with us. And he told me a lot of good stories about Luther, you know, on the road with Luther. But yeah, he had a lot of main events. He and Luther, I saw them wrestle Hawk and Hansen, the Anderson brothers, Bogney and Lubitsch, Skull Murphy and Brute Bernard. Had a lot of main events in the Carolinas.
I remember Bob Caller used to always say, never count out Abe Jacobs, you know, any second now, if he catches that Kiwi roll, it could be over with.
Right. And, you know, Abe was the only guy that knew how to do that Kiwi roll. Many people have tried and failed. And, you know, for the last 40 years that people have been asking, hey, tell us the secret to the Kiwi roll. And he'll tell them something. He said, but it'll be off just a little bit. I won't ever tell them And I've had many people call me out of the blue because they know I'm good friends with Abe. And they'll say, tell me, will Abe tell us what, how does he do the QB roll? I said, you don't, I don't know. You have to ask him. So Abe just kind of chuckles, you know, but yeah, Abe was really close to Luther and they were a terrific team. But Luther is one of the best I had seen. I, you know, Sonny King was good. Bearcat Wright was good. Yeah. Bobo Brazil, you know, I did.
Oh, yeah.
I did a story. I did a story on Bobo back in 1976, I think, and interviewed him backstage at County Hall up in the locker room. And Bobo was a tremendously big guy. I mean, you know, you talk mm-hmm. about legitimately big. I think Bobo was about 6'6", maybe 6'7", well over 300 pounds. And his coup de grace was the cocoa butt. Cocoa butt. But, yeah, and Thunderbolt. Thunderbolt's right up there. Thunderbolt.
How about Sailor Art Thomas, Mike?
Like I said, naturally, you know, huge, had muscles. We didn't have any guys in that era back then that looked like Sailor Art Thomas. We just didn't. He was, but Sailor was not the, how do I say this? He wasn't the best mat technician, but you know, he was like a novelty guy, right? And Abe teamed with him too. Abe teamed with Sailor for a long time. Abe used to tell me he'd get a lot of the big guys who really couldn't work well. And Abe was a workhorse, right? And they'd come in and make the hot tag, you know, and that was the deal. But Abe would team with like Man Mountain Mike, Klondike Bill, Sailor Art Thomas, all the big guys who really weren't the best workers. But Sailor was on top. You know, he teamed with Abe, he teamed with Johnny Weaver. He was in a lot of main events down here in the Carolinas, but originally from Madison, Wisconsin. And Sailor is no long with us either, but, you know, part of the great memories of Mid-Atlantic wrestling.
I started wrestling in 1973 is about when I started. I was born and raised in Hampton, Virginia, so I saw him go up there to Hampton Coliseum and scope.
Yeah.
And I moved to Charlotte in 78, so I saw the Charlotte Coliseum matches. Man, it's just, I love that 70s and 80s time frame. I wish, I don't know, I guess there's not a way to do it now, Mike, but I mean, well, you think there'll ever be another tag team, maybe FTR, that will do like the old Anderson's deal where they didn't pin you. They worked on, you know, your arm or your leg or, you know,
body part.
You worked on your body part and beat you down and made you tap out. You think, is that too boring nowadays? You think it'll ever go back to that?
Al, I hate to say it, but I think people have just been so reeducated as to a new style. You know, you look at the fans and they're like in their, you know, 20s or 30s and, you know, they don't even remember really Steve Austin and Hulk Hogan. And we've got a whole new crop of fans.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
You know, we've got some older ones like us that hang on and, you know, I cover the business, so I have to stay a little bit relevant, but I'll be the first to tell you, man, it ain't like the old stuff. And I'm not being like, oh, back in my day and all of this stuff. But you know, back then you had what we call the true believer. You got to remember back in the 60s and 70s, people really believed. And it was incumbent upon the guys in the ring to make sure they believe. Like Valentine, he laid it in. You know, he would not show any light. He laid it in. Wahoo laid it in. All those guys were. And it's just a totally, totally different product today.
Yeah, I miss kayfabe badly. I loved it when to me, it was some of the most fun was not only watching the matches back in the day, but watching the people at ringside.
Yeah, yeah.
It was full. I mean, the old ladies would want to try to beat you with their cane when you can't. I mean, it was awesome, man. Throwing drinks. I mean, you know, you're not supposed to, but you know, throwing drinks in the ring and trying to assault the wrestlers. I mean, I remember when Ole got stabbed a few times.
Greenville.
I mean, back then it was, I mean, people really believed that stuff was real.
Oh, yeah, you know, the guys in the ring were more afraid of the fans than they were their opponent because they're working together. The fans were crazy. Look, I've been hit by fuse, you know, because I used to take pictures, right, back in the 60s, 70s. I'd bring my camera right up to the ring and take photos. One time it was a main event match between Becker and Weaver against the Masked Red Demons, who were really hot. It was a hot feud, and this was the blow off, and fans where it was a sellout crowd. I'm right there taking pictures, And all of a sudden, I hear a thud about 2 feet from my head. And I look, and there's a knife stuck into the canvas 2 feet from my head.
Wow.
Some crazy fan up in the balcony, right? Probably been drinking all night. He threw a knife, and the knife went right into the, they're not aiming at me, I don't think, right? They're aiming for the red demons. Because he was about 5 feet away from me. He had like a headlock on Weaver. But it came a lot closer to me. It was like 2 feet, and that blade stuck right into the canvas, right on the apron.
Wow.
And it was dangerous back then. I remember I just started dating my wife. This was like our first or second date. I took her to County Hall to a wrestling show, right? And I actually told this story at the fan when I was inducted into the Mid-Atlantic Hall of Heroes. I was the first one up. And Flair had called me like 5 minutes before, and he said, "Mike, you won't believe it. Roddy died. Roddy's dead."
Ooh, right before Roddy, you went up. Oh, man.
That's the day Roddy died. And, you know, I said, "Geez, I got to go up. This is the Mid-Atlantic Hall of Heroes, a banquet. And here's David Crockett and Ricky Steamboat and all these guys. We all went up the same year." And the word got around, you know, I told a few people. And, of course, you know, you had to. So it just a somber pall fell on the festivities. So I said, "What am I going to do? How am I going to, you know, I'm the first one up. I'm the guinea pig. I've got to say something." So I just thought of I said, Roddy would like this. I'm going to tell it. And I went up there and, you know, I addressed what had happened. And I said, "Let me tell you this little Roddy Piper story. When my first or second date with my wife to be, took her to a wrestling show, and it was Roddy Piper. And he was a heel, you know, and he was leaving the ring. And, of course, the fans were throwing cups and whatever, you know, flash at him. And I was out there taking photos. And my wife was out. She was, like, standing close to me. So somebody throws something. Roddy ducks. I mean, Roddy was pretty good. He's coordinated. You know, he's ducking. He's used to ducking people. So he ducked, and this cup of beer and ice hit my wife. Splash.
Oh, man.
Over. And I'm thinking, you know, Roddy would have probably did that on purpose, you know. But she, you know, from that point on, she never wanted to go to another wrestling show.
I wonder why.
Spoiled her on wrestling, you know. And I mean, she did go to different functions, and she knew a lot of the guys because they were friends of mine. But she made it up. It was in her mind at that point that she was not going to be a wrestling fan at all. So,
you know, Mike, you were talking about the, we've got some comments from our viewers we want to get to in just a second, but I wanted to add, we were talking about one of my favorite memories going to the matches. I know I've told Kyle, I don't think I've told Pirate Al yet, but it was at the old Rose High School in Greenville. It's now Epps Middle School, and they've got some damage, unfortunately, to the recent hurricane, but hopefully they'll get that fixed. But in the gym there, it was the Rock and Roll Express, the Midnight Express. In June of 1987, and I'll never forget as long as I live. You see, Jim Cornette, we had like literally ringside seats, and Jim Cornette comes by with that tennis racket, and all of a sudden this lady that was probably in her 70s or 80s at the time, she had this big pocketbook, and she nailed him she gave him a good whipping.
It was a stunt, Granny.
Oh, yeah, Cornette dodged a lot of bullets. You know, he went through Louisiana, and crazy fans up there. They were, you know, they'd flatten their tires. They'd wait for him after show. They'd have to hide in somebody else's car to get away from out of the building. Yeah, it was crazy back then. But I love that excitement. I love the fact that fans were that tied into the show. That would make them do crazy. I certainly didn't endorse the, you know, throwing stuff and everything, but that's how can fans be that way today? I mean, they pretty much know it's a show. It's like they're at a concert, you know, with the pyro and the music and all that stuff. But they can appreciate what they see in the ring, but they just don't have, you know, heat, what they called heat back then. Real heat doesn't exist anymore.
Mike, I think I know, it's funny that, Dave just mentioned Cornette, because I think the one thing that would work, the one guy who could get legit heat, if Cornette could just bring it to himself to go work one card in AEW managing the Revival.
They would kill him.
Work the Young Bucks, yes.
They would kill Cornette. He would be the biggest heel in the wrestling business for the past 20 years. I guarantee you. I mean, he would have to be careful again. You know, he would, just like it was back in the 80s.
And I think he wouldn't admit it, but I think if he did it one more time, he'd love it.
He would. You know, I don't know if he would really do it, but if he did, if they could ever talk him into coming in, I'd watch. Yes, I think everybody who watches wrestling would watch.
No question about it. Let's go to some of our comments, Bubba, if we can. Our great co-host can't be with us tonight, but he's behind the scenes as a producer. I guess we'll start off with one of our good friends, Stevie Fly, who is a huge wrestling fan, Mike, and I know he's enjoying this. He said, "What's up, guys?" And I know that he's says enjoying this, talking about you, Mike. He's a true legend of the wrestling world, so I want to give him a shout out. And thank you, Stevie, for watching tonight. Here, I tell you what, wrestling fans, a lot of us agree. And here's another one for Archie. Ivan Koloff and Dusty Rhodes was the first casket match, right, Mike?
You know, they very well may have been. I remember putting that result up on my Facebook page not too long ago. I don't remember personally. I don't remember any other casket match. I mean, that's pretty hardcore, you know, back in the day. I mean, we had fence matches, we had brass knucks matches. We had stretcher matches, you know, even back in the day, but I don't remember going as far as a casket match. You know, that's more modern. So that very well could have been the first.
They actually had the casket in the middle of the ring, Mike. Is where it was. It wasn't like the Undertaker on the outside of the ring. It was in the middle of the ring. And I remember toward the end of it, Dusty hit him with the big bionic elbow. And you could see Ivan kind of look over his shoulder to make sure when he fell in the casket, you know, he didn't just hit him on the side of the side.
Where was that now? What territory was it?
I don't remember, but I saw it on YouTube or something. That's what I do, guys, like when I'm caught up on work. I'll go online to like YouTube or whatever, and I'll look up old wrestling matches. And just,
yeah,
I don't know, I like old school.
I've been obsessed, Al, because I didn't get to see it growing up with Memphis. So since I didn't get to watch Memphis growing up in the Crockett territories, I'll go watch all the Memphis stuff with Jerry Lawler and you know, Tommy Rich. Like I said, he was used on top in Memphis.
Yeah.
God, trying to think of some of the other guys. Obviously, Bill Dundee and all those guys that I missed. And the Memphis stuff was good. There was a little more Gaga with that stuff in the 80s than there was JCP. But it wasn't WWE or WWF Gaga. It was its own thing.
Well, some of the jobbers they had, what they called jobbers back in the day, they would. I mean, they had some of the ridiculous ones. Mike, you remember the he became Hillbilly Jim, but before he was Hillbilly Jim, he was Harley Davidson.
Absolutely.
So introduce him. You know, you'd always say where they're from. Of course, Harley Davidson from everywhere, and they had another guy named the Pink Panther. I mean, you know, come on, man. I mean, you remember the Pink Panther, Mike?
Yeah, you know, I know a lot of those mask guys, but let me tell you, I've done columns on like when Mask Man were Mask Man.
Right.
Those guys used to be the top. They used to be the top guys. You know, now in later years, they were like jabronis. They were like job guys. Yeah. But if you came into a territory and you wore a mask, you were a guy of mystery. You were usually a main eventer right off the bat. And that's how many guys who were in other territories might have been the opening, might have been a curtain jerker, right?
Right.
But he'd go to another territory, he'd be a main eventer automatically by wearing the mask. You know, Billy and Jimmy Hines, they were the Red Demons. Mm-hmm. They weren't main eventers everywhere, but when they hit the Carolinas and Virginias, the Red Demons had George Two-Ton Harris as their manager.
One of my favorites of all time. His facial expressions when he got nailed by the other wrestler. I mean, to me, Mike, I've never laughed so hard in my life. I mean, those facial expressions that George Two-Ton Harris.
Oh, yeah, you know, 350 pounds. He would grab a headlock on somebody and he'd say, I got you now.
Oh, yeah.
And then five seconds later, he'd be on the mat, right? I got you now. And then the fans would start booing him, and he'd look at the fans and say, shut up.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Jeff Jarrett, I remember Double J used to always saying, I got him now. Did he take that for 200?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. George was doing it back in the 60s, yeah. But he was, you know, and George, you know, George was a great guy. He never learned to read or write. Jim Crockett Sr. always took care of him. He was, you know, a firm influence with the Crockett family. A very nice guy. In fact, we invited George to the it was like one of the first real reunions that were being held back in the, and this was in 1998 at the Old County Hall in Charleston. It was called the A Night to Remember, a tribute to Henry Marcus, who was our promoter here for 30 or 40 years, and Mid-Atlantic Legends reunion. It was a lot of the old Mid-Atlantic guys like Johnny Valentine, Tim Woods, Thunderbolt Patterson, you know, really just top of the line guys. But we invited George, and George came in the ring just like the same ring he was in 50, 40 years ago. And he did the thing where he'd be walking and strutting and doing his hair, and the fans just went crazy. George was such a great guy. You know, George managed the Red Demons when they were really on top back here in the late 60s. And the Red Demons, very colorful with the red hoods. And George wore a completely red suit. Oh, he was the only guy other than Santa Claus I ever saw wear a completely red suit. And he'd done main events early in his career, but for laughs, George was a great fan favorite.
Yeah, he was. I remember him very well. Like I said, I started in 73, so back then, Rep Hawkins, Sweet Hansen, Gene and Ole Anderson. Yes. Johnny Weaver. Of course, it's, you know, it was hilarious, Mike, whenever. Do you guys remember this? Whenever Johnny Weaver would put you in the sleeper hold, Dave, you remember this?
Weaver lock.
After the match was over, the referee, you know, of course, Johnny would have to, you know, like he was going to walk out of the ring, would have to grab his arm and say, no, you got to go back here.
Wake him up.
He would bend him over, kind of rub his neck a little bit.
Well, he knocked it
back. And then the guy started, you know, he woke up from throwing his arms around.
Yeah. Remember that? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember that. Remember when Becker and Weaver used to do the row the boat? Get two guys in the middle of the ring and row the boat. You never see any of that stuff anymore. I don't know why. Great stuff.
Oh, man.
Mike. Bobby Shane work before he passed away?
Who? What's that?
Did you ever get to see Bobby Shane work before he got killed?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I love Bobby. He was, I watched him when he was like maybe 18, 19 years old coming up in the business. Real name was Bobby Schoenberger out of St. Louis, Missouri. His uncle had been a ref up there. And you talk about a student of the game. I'm glad you mentioned you brought his name up, because honestly, I thought Bobby was so good, and he died so tragically in that airplane crash over Tampa Bay back in 75, 76. But I thought Bobby had the goods to be an NWA world champion. I really do. Yeah. I think he would have been – he would have probably changed the course of the wrestling industry. Because I think he would have been – he had the background coming out of St. Louis. You know, Sam Muchnick knew him, and he sort of had the he had connections early on. But he ate, slept. Everything was wrestling to Bobby. Bobby loved it with a passion from the time he was a kid. And Bobby was so good as a baby face, you know, the young, good-looking guy, trying to win a world championship. I saw him wrestle Konieski in Savannah, and this was early in Bobby's career. I mean, they had a whale of a match. I think they went 60 minutes. But as a heel later, you know, he was over tremendously in Georgia and here in the Carolinas. He teamed a little with Rip Hawk mentored him some, and went to Florida and became King Bobby Shane. I mean, he was a great heel. What a great heel. You know, he had a valid.
How was he on promos?
Oh, he's great. Oh, he was great.
I can't quite remember him.
Yeah. You know, the heel, he grew that handlebar mustache and, you know, the bleach blonde hair. And he had a valet named Winston. Then he had a valet named Sherry, who was his real life wife. And the promos he cut, like I said, everywhere he went, he was not only a great in-ring guy, but he had so many creative ideas. I mean, he was like almost going to be in the mold of an Eddie Graham. He was going to be a great booker. And I think he would have still been relevant in the business today. There's just no telling where Bobby might have ended up, but yeah, he had tremendous, tremendous talent.
And even in death, one more comment, Dave, even in death, Bobby Shane had a huge impact on the wrestling business historically.
Yep.
Because right before he died, what did he do? He gave Jerry Lawler his gimmick.
The crown. Yep. King of wrestling. Gave him the crown. Yep. Yep. He did.
So much. Yeah, I'm sorry. We got a whole bunch of comments from our viewers, so I want to get them in from Mike. A lot of people obviously want to chime in. Good friend Alan Vick. Is that Zack Sabre Jr. and MJF, two of the best young wrestlers in a long time?
MJF, yes.
MJF, one of the best heels I've seen in a long time. And that's saying a lot. I mean, that guy has natural heel charisma, you know. He comes in the ring and you automatically, he's one of those guys you just don't like, you know. And he plays that role so good. And he's, you know, fairly young guy. Probably the top heel in all elite wrestling right now. He's got a great future.
All right, let's go to some more Bubba. I appreciate Bubba Rosenbaum producing tonight. I know his family's a little under the weather, so thank you, man, for multitasking. Let's go to, is it Danny? I guess Danny's comment. We'll go to that next. Let's see. There we go. Danny Lyles, he said, Mid-Atlantic wrestling on Saturday mornings for me hit this time slot between Fat Albert at noon and Soul Train at 1:30. Ah, the good old days.
Oh, man. Don Cornelius, Soul Train. Hippest ride in the country.
Soul Train.
Love that show.
Yeah, I associate Soul Train with wrestling also because NWA, late 80s, originally, time slot was 7 p.m. on WNCT. WWF ended up going on WCTI at the same time when Hogan started to get hot. And they moved it to 12:30 a.m. on WNCT, and yep. Soul Train would come on from 11:30 to 12:30. So I'd have to sit, you know, as a little kid, I'd have to sit through Soul Train, and did not give two craps about watching it. And like Pirate Al, who I'm sure was enjoying it with his love of old school hip hop, and I'd have to sit through that and wait for my Jim Crockett Wrestling to come on at 12:30 a.m.
There you go. Shout out to Danny Lyles. Hi, Danny. Thanks for the question.
All right. William Grant, Bubba. We have another Bubba, obviously. William Bubba Grant loved Roddy Piper. When you're talking about that, I know he commented back there in your Roddy Piper story.
Yeah. Talk about a guy with charisma. Roddy had it. I mean, dating back to when he first started, you know, with Georgia Championship Wrestling and Mid-Atlantic Wrestling. He was a great like companion to Ric Flair. You know, they could bounce off of one another. We've done several radio shows together with Rick and Roddy and myself. And to see those two go back and forth, you know, you just feel the real bond between them. And it was very tough for Rick when Roddy passed away. I mean, you know, the funny thing is, Roddy said years ago that he would not make it past the age of 60-something. He gave me I don't know if it was 65 or 64, whatever. But he actually did not make it. You know, he kind of knew, had premonition that, you know, what he had gone through in the wrestling business, he just didn't feel like he was going to make it to an old age. It was very sad.
Didn't he break into territory, Mike, when he was about 16 or so up in Portland, Oregon, in that area?
Yeah, he did. He was very young. It might have been 16 years old. And I think he used to tell the story. I think his first match was with Larry Hennig. Larry Zach Hennig's a big guy, right? And Roddy was scared. And Roddy back then was, you know, he was a skinny guy. He had no muscle definition or anything. But yeah, he tells a story about that match. Larry took care of him, and then I think his one of his next matches was with Mad Dog Vachon. So they were not being kind to Roddy in booking back then. But look what it actually paid dividends because he grew up fast.
Was Roddy? We got a comment from somebody, but I had a follow up from Roddy. Was he the first? Probably not, but I've seen video on YouTube of him in Georgia in the 70s and him doing commentary with Gordon Sully as a heel. And I guess he turned face because of somebody attacking Gordon. But was he the first heel commentator as a wrestler? You know, a wrestler that was a heel commentator?
Actually, I think Vince McMahon was the first heel commentator without knowing it back then. If you saw some of Vince's early stuff.
Yeah.
He just didn't know it.
Gotcha.
Let's put the Archie's comment back up there, Bubba. Dusty, his Hard Times promo was the greatest of all time, and the rise of the Four Horsemen.
Yeah, Archie. Yeah, my friend. He was I think that will probably go down as one of the greatest promos of all time when Dusty did the Hard Times promo and Bob Caudle was right there with him. That was great.
I'll tell you something, guys, that I never realized. When I went to the wrestling reunion in Charlotte, but Gordon, my dream was always to have lunch with Gordon Soley, just sit down with him for an hour, have lunch and just talk wrestling. I wish I would have had that chance, but I met his daughter,
Pam
Allen. And she told me, and I had no idea this, Gordon had no idea when the wrestling show was going on. He had no idea, guys, what was going to happen. That's why he was so authentic.
When
all the matches and when the people would come in and, you know, and jump one of the wrestlers or come in and do a surprise interview.
Yeah.
They didn't tell him what was going to happen. I mean, all that was authentic, and I had no clue about that.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about earlier, the spontaneous nature of everything. It works better that way. And Gordon's just giving us a anatomy lesson as we listen to his commentary. You know, he's putting pressure on the prefrontal lobe. I love that one. You know.
Wait a minute.
Indeed.
Ear sixer.
Ear six brawl. His face is a crimson mask.
Yeah.
He did that a lot. There were a lot of crimson masks during Gordon's time.
Yeah. I think the maddest I ever saw Gordon Soley was when Pac Song broke the picture that I think President Carter's mother painted for him. Pac Song jumped Wrestling 2 on TV and broke the picture over his head. And then he was coming out of, you know, a few weeks later, he was coming out of the hospital Wrestling 2.
Yeah.
And, he was wrestling Ox Baker.
Mm-hmm.
Ox. On TV. Yeah. And Gordon was so worried about, you know, that, you know, Wrestling 2 is not in great shape right now. And God, mm-hmm. he gets hit by that heart punch. And I love those days.
He was great. Bob Caudle was great. I love when Bob would say, there's no place in professional wrestling for this. Of course there is, Bob. It is professional wrestling. There's a lot of, you know, plenty of places for this.
What was that? Lance Russell also.
One of my, you know, I remember a show I attended. It was Clash of Champions back, I think, in 89 or 90. It was held in Charleston. And I knew I would never be among a greater group of announcers at one time because we were backstage and all talking. And I had Gordon Soley. I did interviews, I think, that night on several of the guys. But had Gordon Soley here, Bob Caudle here, Lance Russell here.
God.
And Jim Ross here.
Wow.
Tony Schiavone was in the mix too. But, you know, that was like announcing greatness in one room. And such announcers. You know, Jim had often told me that, you know, Gordon Soley was his he was a guy, you know, and as good as Jim was, he'd always say Gordon Solie was the best. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard to pick from those guys. I really liked all of them, but that's another big benefit fans had back then. They had great, great announcers, and and they made you feel a part of the show. It's just, you know.
I heard somebody mention the other day, and I had never noticed it before. I heard somebody mention this, but when you think about it, you can picture it in your head. Somebody said watching Bob Caudle hold his mic, it looks like he's trying to keep it from floating up the whole time he's talking. It's like it's got helium in it. It's like it wants to float up. And up, and he's trying to hold it down.
Yeah, what a great guy Bob is too. You know, thank you. He's still with us.
No doubt about it. We got another comment. One of the shows I really love was Beyond the Ring. Alan Vick has a question again. Wonder why, with everything that's known now, why Jose Gonzalez was never implicated in Bruiser Brody's murder. It's painfully obvious what happened with Tony Atlas's account, Dutch Mantell, etc.
It's horrible. You know, it was a matter of nobody going back to Puerto Rico to testify. So without any witnesses there, you know, and I don't know how the legal system was in Puerto Rico back in 1987, but the guy got away with murder. He really did. And it's, I know I've talked to some of the guys who were there, probably most notably Tony Atlas. And Tony told me that he never got information of appearing in court, you know, like the court date is in a month. He never got any correspondence concerning when he needed to be there to testify. And I don't know if that was the case with everybody, but there was nobody to testify against Gonzalez. You know, Tony Atlas was right there. He saw what happened. He was right there in the locker room. And, you know, he's the one that took Bruiser to the hospital.
Wow.
And such a sad thing. And, yeah, I kind of wondered why a lot of those guys ever worked in Puerto Rico again, but I guess it's a wrestling business, and they, you know, they had a job and they were closely connected with Carlos Colon. But Invader One, he's still there wrestling in Puerto Rico. He's still alive, you know, doing work there. So,
yeah, I heard an interview with Savio Vega where, you know, and he's a Puerto Rican guy, and he admitted that, you know, he knows that it was murder. He was guilty. I wonder how well he's able to. I don't know if Savio is still in the States or if he's back in Puerto Rico. I wonder how that goes over, being a native and admitting it was murder.
I think they're all resigned to the fact. You know, business is business, and I don't know what led to that. I think there are a lot of theories out there that there was some underlying hate between Gonzalez and Brody that maybe Bruiser was making some demands, or, you know, it could have been a money thing. I mean, there was a reason that happened, and there's nothing to explain to justify that. But I don't think we'll ever know exactly how this guy could have committed such a crime, and, you know, nothing, no jail time, nothing at all.
Are you surprised that Carlito, you know, Carlos Colon's son, was able to come to the States and have a somewhat successful career after all that in the WWE?
Yeah, and I know Corley. He's worked down here a few times. And, you know, I certainly don't blame him, or, you know, and like I said, Carlos was associated. I'm sure Carlos knows what really happened and why. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you just got to let that go, I guess.
Yeah, and you mentioned guys working down there after that. No, Dutch Mantell spent a lot of time booking down there after that.
Yeah, I've talked to Dutch about it too. Yeah, a lot of guys, just about, I don't think anybody, you know, even Abdullah the Butcher, who was good friends with Brody, did great business with him. You know, he's been going back to Puerto Rico for years. So it's just, it's terrible what happened, because Brody had many, many good years left in him.
Yeah.
And I guess people back then said, well, it's only pro wrestling. you know.
Did it surprise you, Mike, that Brody never made a run on Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling? He never really – I can't remember him ever really being in the territory.
I don't think he ever worked here.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think
he surprised that he never did?
Yeah, kind of. I'm sure maybe had he lived longer, he, you know, would have made it down here. But then, too, that was toward the end of the territory days.
Yeah.
You know, that was like 87. There was not much of a territory by then. But I never remember him working. And honestly, I don't know a reason why he didn't make it. Like a lot of guys would come through maybe just for a week or two. But mm-hmm. they would do shots down here when they were in the area. So it could have been, that's a good question, it could have been something between Crockett, maybe Crockett was afraid to use him because Brody had a little reputation.
Right.
You know, being hard to work with in the ring.
Well, I remember the match that he had with Luger that in the cage match that didn't go so well, you know?
No. two entirely different styles.
Did Luger just, like, leave that match? What's the story with that?
Alan, you just saw it.
No, well, I just know that he wouldn't
he wouldn't cooperate.
He wouldn't sell for Luger. They got in the steel cage, and he was Brody was kind of putting on Luger a little bit, and he wouldn't sell at all when Luger came back. And then finally, I guess Luger was a little bit scared for his life, to be honest with you, or thought he was going to get harmed, and he got the heck. Climbed over the cage and got out of there.
Yeah, he just left the match. Climbed over the cage.
Right. Yeah, Lex would probably do that. I don't blame him. But he had kind of a similar thing with Stan Hansen when Stan worked with Lex.
Oh my gosh!
I feel sorry for Lex because Stan was really throwing in those lariats. I mean, he would tell you. You know, Stan would really potato you, and I mean, he would hurt you. But in his defense, he would tell the guys after the match, you know, Stan couldn't see. You know, Stan was almost blind, right? Stan wore these big, thick glasses. So when he didn't have them in the ring, he couldn't see that well. And sometimes he was pretty hard. That lariat was the real deal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know when he and Vader used to have their matches.
Oh
God, you better – oh, wow.
Yeah.
Guys, Stan Hansen happens to be my hero. A guy who's legally blind and chews tobacco.
All right. Stan just had a birthday. I think it was yesterday, 71.
Well, wow. Okay. I identify a lot with Stan, and I guarantee you if I hit you with a clothesline, it's going to land somewhere between your chin and your chest also.
Yes.
You know, one of my favorite wrestlers, guys, just as far as just being a – I just thought it was wonderful, was a superstar.
Delete.
Absolutely. He's just, you know, demolition. To me, I always know, you know, like him the best as superstar, but yeah, demolition. Then Bolo Mongol, I believe. You know,
Bolo Mongol, yes. What a transformation of characters, huh?
Wow. And he could cut a promo. Wow. He was fantastic.
He could. Bill was really good. And Bill's a nice guy. And, you know, I love the transformations he made. One week, he was in the Mid-Atlantic Territory wrestling as one of the Mongols with Professor Boris Maximilianovich Blanco as the manager.
The cigar, Mike.
Right. Remember he burned Igor with it?
Oh, yeah.
And a week later, he was still in the Mid-Atlantic Territory as the mass superstar. And nobody knew the difference.
Yeah,
so he could pull that off in a week. Yeah, in a week. And then, of course, years later, he would turn up as one of Demolition Acts, you know, with Smash as Demolition, the team. So really, really great worker. What a good guy, too.
Yeah, he is. When I went to the wrestling reunion, out of everybody that I talked to, and there were some great guys there, he was probably – I mean, he was asking more questions about wrestling than I was. Him, which is incredible. This guy's a superstar. No pun intended, but I mean, he was asking me. So, Alan, tell me who were some of your favorite wrestlers. And tell me some of the funniest things you saw. I mean, just I was blown away that he actually cared what I thought.
I got to see him wrestle as Demolition Axe against the Barbarian. God, I don't know if he's still working, but this was in 2010 in Moorhead City. Demolition Axe, Barbarian. in Morehead City. It was a great little independent card. And the main event that night was Tommy Dreamer versus C.W. Anderson in a rematch submission match.
Yeah. Yeah, Bill had his last – Bill actually worked a match because I did a story on his final match, and I think he wrestled one time later too. But that was about 2 years ago. He still worked a match.
Wow. Amazing. Wow,
yeah.
Mike, I want to talk about your book because the guy that you probably already know the story, but one of the – I was reading that last night knowing you were coming on. Mm-hmm. One of our favorites, local guy, and he married this guy right here. Ivan Koloff, the Russian Bear, you had that nice article. I don't want to give it away, but something that we forget about is someone that I thought a lot of. I met him once, actually, at the Walmart here where I live in Williamson years ago, and he was such a kind guy, giving back money to the Children's Miracle Network locally for the in Greenville at Vita Medical Center, the Children's Hospital. He was doing that. He said he went to all the out of the goodness out of his heart, he was going when he retired to all the Walmarts.
He did
charge like $5 for a signed photo. He would take pictures with you. A great guy. And you had a great article at a great point about him not being in the WWE Hall of Fame. How is that possible?
You know what? That's really a huge injustice to not have Ivan in every Hall of Fame there is. I certainly thought he would be in when I would have loved to have him gone in the same year that Bruno Sammartino did.
Yeah.
Bruno, it was a holdout. And when Bruno finally agreed to go, you know, he mentioned Ivan Koloff and it didn't work. I mean, Ivan, it would have been the great bookend deal to have Ivan and Bruno go in the same year. Of course, you know, Ivan is the one that ended Bruno Sammartino's 4.5 year reign as WWE world champion. Back in the early 70s, and it was at Madison Square Garden, and people went silent, couldn't believe it. And Ivan has had he had such a tremendous career. For him not to be and never what he never has been, you know, I always held out hope that while he was still here with us, it would have been such a nice thing for them to put Ivan in the Hall of Fame. He and Renee would have had such a wonderful time because when WWE really lays out the red carpet when they induct someone in the Hall of Fame, it's like a week of activities. And Ivan should have been honored in that way. And the only reason I can think of that he wasn't is because he was part of a class action lawsuit that a bunch of guys – an attorney up north got in touch with a bunch of guys who had wrestled for Vince over the years. And it was a lawsuit based on the, you know, concussions, you know, which was a big deal in wrestling, has been for a while. But he got a bunch of guys, and I think Bill Eady was one too. You know, Bill's not in the WWE Hall of Fame either. And I think Vince really held it against the guys who were in that lawsuit. And I know a lot of them kind of got in there half-heartedly, you know, and didn't know this was going to maybe impact them for a long time. Because the lawsuit really didn't have a good chance of succeeding. You know, Vince has got the best attorneys in the country. And you would have to spend a lot of money to win a case against them. And also some of the guys on that lawsuit, the list, they had maybe, you know, wrestled for Vince for maybe a few months. And how can you say that that these guys suffered physical damage while working for Vince, you know, when they were only there for maybe a year or less, and they had wrestled maybe 15 years for hundreds of other promoters. So you really couldn't pin it down to Vince. It was a lawsuit that didn't have a good chance of succeeding. But I honestly think that's why Ivan was not inducted, chosen to be inducted in the Hall of Fame. Probably not the best reason in the world, because Ivan meant so much to WWF back then. Worldwide Wrestling Federation, but he meant so much to the entire wrestling business. You know, he was a worldwide star, and he was such a good guy, you know, such a nice, kind man that, and he was able to portray, you know, this terrible Russian heel, and he did it so well. But, you know, I'm sorry Ivan did not get to experience that. I think that was a real injustice to everyone.
Last time I got to see Ivan in person, I was at some store in Kinston, and I saw Ivan, or my wife actually spotted him. She said, "There's Ivan Koloff." And I had met Ivan several times living in Eastern North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Walked over to him and said, "Comrade." And I got his hand, and he remembered me, or either he BS'd it really well if he didn't remember me. I said, "What are you doing here in town?" And he had came to Kinston. He got his days mixed up. It was he thought that the county fair was going on. This is maybe 07. And the county fair was going on, and he came to watch the Demolition Derby, but it was the day before. And he was just hanging around town, seeing who he could run into.
Yeah, a lot of people knew and loved Ivan. He was an ordained minister. Who would have thought that Soviet menace would become a Christian ordained Christian minister years later on?
That one of the best nights I ever had was he. My wife and I actually went out with dinner with he and Renee the night before he married us, and yeah. I'll cherish those memories. He was, of course, like you said, Mike. He was telling the story about coming off the top rope, pinning Bruno, and how you could hear a pin drop. Everybody thought he was unbeatable. Bruno was unbeatable, and they had to have actually security get him out of there, Madison Square Garden.
What a great moment, you know. And that moment is etched in everyone's memory who is a longtime wrestling fan, and such an iconic image of Ivan coming off the top rope with the knee drop, you know. And wouldn't that have been a magnificent backdrop for his induction? You know,
it would have been perfect.
I mean, I think that was an opportunity missed.
And then he would tell me stories about, you know, the plane trips overseas, and how they, you know, how rowdy the, you know, got on the plane. And I think the one guy he really wanted to seriously fight was Iron Sheik. He wasn't a big Iron Sheik fan, Mike.
Hey, Iron Sheik wouldn't have humbled Ivan. No way.
No, but he said, Ivan said when they got off the plane, you know, it was, you know, he went up to the Iron Sheik and said, basically, hey, you know, if you want to go, let's go. I mean, it's like, you know, playing around here. So
Ivan was legitimately tough. Yeah, he was. Yeah. And he was,
yeah. Yeah, but how high was he? Might have made a difference.
Mike, if you'll talk a little bit about your book, I've got one, but it's fantastic. If you'll talk about that, please.
Okay, the last book.
Yes. Well, all of them, really. But, yeah, I know the Final Bell. But
yeah, Final Bell was the last book I wrote. That was last year. And it's a look at some of my friends in the business who have passed on. And it's actually reprinted columns that I did over the years. So those columns, they were fresh when I wrote them. You know, I didn't change anything around. And those – I think more people know me in the wrestling business from those kind of columns that I've written when a friend of mine passes away, because it's very emotional for me. I mean, these are not just wrestling stars. They're friends, personal friends, and very hard to write. Some of course, harder than others, but it's a compilation of 36, 37 wrestling stars. And I don't refer to them as obituaries. I refer to them more as remembrances. And it's a varied list of people. It was hard picking just, you know, I've done probably 200 or 300. Unfortunately, they never stop. We've had quite a few over the last couple of years since I wrote the book. Guys like Harley Race, and but anyway, it's you know, it's men like Luthez, guys who were in the Mid-Atlantic Territory, Johnny Weaver, Tim Woods, and guys like Freddie Blassie, Sputnik Monroe, you know, from all walks of life and all kind of different characters. And of course, the promoters. One of my favorite pieces was the one I did on Henry Marcus, who, you know, the first wrestling promoter I ever knew when I first started attending shows back in the 60s. And he promoted here in Charleston and Columbia and some smaller towns like Florence and Sumter, who had occasional shows, for probably 30 or 40 years. And he was a promoter extraordinaire. He did mostly wrestling, but he also did, you know, Ice Capades, Harlem Globetrotters, rock and roll review shows with Dick Clark. And I mean, he traveled the road, you know, on trains with Jack Dempsey, Rocky Marciano. Just goes back a long way. It had so many great stories. Actually, in Columbia, he had the original Superman, George Reeves and Lois Lane. You know, they used to do shows back then, and he had them in a big park in Columbia. But I did one on Henry Marcus, and we actually had an event in 1998 in Charleston, a tribute to Henry Marcus. And it was a few years before he passed away, but he was like 87 at the time. But we had him right there in the ring, like the old days, with all of the old guys. You know, we had all of the old stars around him. Johnny Valentine, Fabulous Moolah. We had the girls, too. Fabulous Moolah, Penny Banner, Mae Young, Diamond Lil. You know, the whole cast of characters. Thunderbolt Patterson, Mr. Wrestling. We had a whole bunch. It was a huge weekend, and it was an honor. It was a tribute to Henry Marcus. So that's one of my favorite pieces in the book. I also did, you know, stuff on Jim Barnett, some of the announcers who had passed, a good friend of mine, Lance Russell, Gordon Soley, of course, the Walter Cronkite of professional wrestling. So it's a book that covers a lot of bases. And, you know, Wahoo McDaniel's in there. It's just guys I'd known really well. And that was my sort of tribute to them. And it's Final Bell, Jim Rawlinson, Les Thatcher did the foreword to the book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can find it. It's on Amazon. It's on Evening Post Books Publishing, but it's also, you can find it on Amazon. But, you know, it's from the heart. That's what the main thing I can say about it. It's from the heart. Very, very close to me.
It's great. I've really enjoyed reading
it. I started reading it yesterday. Great book, Mike. And, certainly, I appreciate you coming on with us tonight. I'm sorry we were having so much fun. It's been time is rolling by really fast. But I know that the guys we have on this podcast right now, we could talk about wrestling for hours. But certainly from the late 70s to the present time, I would have to say that the late 70s and early 80s, when you're a little kid and you see Ric Flair going for the gold and one of my favorite matches, I used to think that, I mean, Starcade was kind of like, for a kid, wrestling was like like Christmas. I know it wasn't, but that was more like, was it Thanksgiving back then?
It was Thanksgiving, yeah.
Yeah. But it felt more like Christmas for a little kid when you're like 9 and 10 years old and Flair for the gold. I mean, and then with him and Harley Race, I know Harley just passed away, I believe. Was it last year?
Last year, yeah.
And, but the two of them were some of the epic matches. I wanted to ask you, one of my favorite matches was, the two of the best to me in the ring. I know people talk about it a lot, but I think the Ric Flair Steamboat matches, in the late 80s, that go 60 minutes and you were never bored, was one of my all time favorite matches.
They were some of mine too. They had a trilogy of matches back in 89, you know, Those were absolutely fan. They were matches of the year for sure. And, you know, Rick was getting up in age then, but that was one of his, you know, he could still do it. He could still bring it. But I always tell people who ask me about this, how can you get, you know, those matches were fantastic. How could you do any better? But really, I saw those guys go at it like that back in the 70s, you know, 10 years before they wrestled that series of matches in 89, they were actually doing that stuff here in the Carolinas back in the late 70s, but it wasn't televised. You know, nobody had footage back then. You know, we didn't have access to all of that stuff. And they were mainly at house shows with no TV cameras present, you know. But it's amazing that they could 10, 11, 12 years later present that same kind of intensity and quality of a match. You know, they really did paint a picture, a beautiful portrait.
No doubt about it.
Things I remember about that feud between Flair and Steamboat in 89 that I think people forget is how Steamboat was brought in to the NWA. He was brought in as Eddie Gilbert's mystery tag team partner, Flair and Anderson. And I think that's so weird. You know, when you think about that feud, you forget Eddie Gilbert was involved in it.
I know. And, you know, Eddie was a booker for WCW for a while. Eddie was another great creative mind. You know, he came out of Tennessee. So, you know, he did the angles with Jerry Lawler and stuff. He had that kind of, you know, Jerry Jarrett was another great creative guy. So Eddie came from really good stock.
Loved Eddie Gilbert.
All right, Al, do you have anything before we go, my friend? I know you got to work in the morning.
No, hey, you guys still have to work. You need to retire like me.
I'd love to do this sometime in the future, Mike. I tell you, I know we've been on an hour and a half, man. There's a bunch more questions I have, but this 90 minutes flew by. I had a blast.
Me too.
But I really appreciate you coming on and thank you.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I certainly had a good time. And, you know, you can catch me on Facebook as Alan, you probably know, I post a lot of old results and, you know, on this day and a lot of the old stuff back then. And I try to keep the old school torch burning, you know.
And we appreciate it.
A friend of mine, Blaine, lives in Charlotte. I went to high school at East Mecklenburg in Charlotte. But anyway,
we put Keller
on there, like, you know, No, Flair. You know, Flair had his foot on the rope. You know, it really didn't. You know, I know he lost.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. He cheated. Yeah, Blaine's funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He and I went to high school together. So
is that right? Good. Okay, good to know. Mm-hmm. Were you a tag team back then?
No,
North Carolina Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, I can see. I can see Pirate Al off the top rope with the elbow. Yeah.
Hey, I'll say this, and I'll let it go because I know we're running out of time here. But the funniest out of all the matches I've been to live, the funniest I've ever seen in my life was Ivan Koloff versus Don Kernodle back in, I think, around 82, 83, somewhere in there, where it was flag versus flag.
Oh, yeah.
Charlotte Coliseum. Okay, so both the wrestlers came down with the flags, and whatever wrestler won, they got to hold their flag up in the middle of the ring.
Yeah.
Or the other flag. I can't remember what it was exactly. Anyway, so it's about 10 minutes into the match. This guy runs up out of the crowd. This guy runs up with a Russian flag and starts running around the Charlotte Coliseum. You're sitting there, you got Kernodle and Koloff there trying to wrestle, and you got 15,000 people watching, you know, these 5 or 6 security guards chasing this guy all around the Coliseum.
You can only find that in professional wrestling, right? Yes. You're talking about the privates, Nelson and Kernodle, right?
Yes.
You know, I shot Sarge a message a while back saying, Sarge, it was never the same after you lost your privates. And he had a big smiley face on there. Says, "Okay, you're right. It hasn't been."
And that's an order.
Yeah, right. Maggot, do some push-ups, Maggot.
Yeah,
Mike. Thanks, man. Appreciate you coming on tonight. It means a lot to us, wrestling fans. And I look forward to reading the rest of the book. And again, fans, get on Amazon.com. I got it for my Kindle, so I can take it everywhere with me, and even on my iPhone. So appreciate it very much for all you've done for the sport, and definitely love to have you back on again.
Thank you. I had a great time, Dave, Kyle, and Alan. We'll do this again soon.
All right, sounds good.
Thanks, Mike.
That's all the public. That's all the people need to know.
That's right.
Oh my goodness, what a show! Thank you, Mike.
Only in wrestling can we do this on a sports show.
That's exactly right.
All right.
Have a good night.
Thanks.
All right. Good night. What a great show there, guys. And Pirate Al, before we go, I know it's been a wrestling show, but what about the very fact the Pirates were able to practice today? I want to get a quick thought before we go.
Ecstatic. Now, how long will it last? I don't know, but we can't afford another break between now and I hope September 19th, because I'm telling you, even though they had 10 players that opted out today, we don't need to play Central Florida that first game without having like an FCS game beforehand. We really need to play on the 19th. I'm hoping something works out. Western Carolina, Elon, I don't care. Somebody, we need to play a game before that.
Yeah, tired out. Get with me off there. That definitely needs to happen. Unfortunately, I don't think John Gilbert's going to let it happen. If he schedules an FCS game, he wants to be able to have revenue, even though it's going to be limited revenue, so it would probably be in October. I think it's going to be a losing battle for Gilbert to try to make that happen. But I'm with you 100%. I've been preaching it all along. We desperately need to play someone before we play UCF. I mean, you're leading the lambs to slaughter, in my opinion. If you not to mention they open up with Georgia Tech on the 19th, so it ain't a smart thing to do. And one more thing, Dave, and then we'll wrap this up about this. I understand the rules with COVID testing. But if other schools are not enforcing contact tracing to the letter of the law, if we're going to, then something needs to be enforced to make other schools do it too. But it's so hard to be enforced. But you can't sit here and tell me, and I have no evidence, but you can't sit here and convince me no other school in the American has had a game delayed yet. Everybody's still kicking off on time. Some schools are kicking off this weekend in the American. Memphis, SMU, Navy. And you just can't convince me somehow we're the only school in the American that's had to have a game delayed if everybody else is enforcing things as strict as we are in terms of contact tracing. And I just don't believe it's being done at other places to the letter of the law, because the testing you have to show accountability for, but the contact tracing, man, you can skirt that. It's really hard to enforce, and I'm not faulting our administration for enforcing it, but I want to know – I just don't think other places are.
And I understand Marshall hadn't tested in 3 weeks. So, I mean, how do you get by with that?
They don't have to. Conference USA didn't require it during practice, but they're going to have to test this week. But, again, you know, if they have 8 guys test positive, what they're probably going to do, Al, is just sit those 8 guys and not bother doing any contact tracing.
And
that's what screwed us up. It wasn't the guys we had test positive. It was all the other guys that we had quarantined who weren't even sick. Because of contact tracing.
I know. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Hey, good news today, guys, on the wide receiver from Florida, you know, Theodore Lockley, he committed to us. So that was nice. I guess us, Utah and Cincinnati, and he went our way. So we needed that one. That was good.
Yeah. We had some big time offers, and definitely that was a huge pickup for those of us that know East Carolina as wide receiver U, and certainly. We've had some greats, but man, that's going to be, he's going to be one of the next chapters with us. See, can you imagine guys, him and CJ Johnson on the same field? Oh my goodness. That's going to be, and if we've got more than just CJ Johnson, but I was just saying those guys, it's going to be fantastic. All right.
Hey, I'm going to stick my neck out here, guys. 2021, with what we got coming back, we're going to contend for the, American Conference title.
Yeah, I think we definitely could. And 2020, I'm going to stick my neck out. John Gilbert, please let us play football. I'm begging you. I'm begging you, John. Please do anything you can to let us play football. Don't try to go the other way with it.
I'll let you have the last word, Kyle. Thanks to Mike Mooneyham. What a great author. Man, what a great guest. A lot of great people watching and listening. Appreciate y'all so much for all the wrestling fans around the nation, around the world, and right here in the Sports Objective Nation, sure, too. All right, guys, we're going to get out of here. For Mike Mooneyham, Pirate Al, and Kyle Barber, I'm Dave Richmond. Thanks to Bubba Rosenbaum behind the scenes, and you've been watching and listening to Sports Objective. Good night, everybody, and go Pirates!
You've been listening to the Sports Objective Podcast. Join us next time as the guys will be objective, and the objective is sports.